Hello, and welcome to New Books in Popular Music, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Matt Smith Larman, and on this episode, I'll be talking with Joe Carducci, author of Enter Naomi, SST, LA, and All That, a book released in 2007 on Joe's own Readout Press. Joe is the author of a few other books, including Rock and the Pop Narcotic, the most recent edition being from 2005, and Wyoming Stories, published in 2008. He also has two books forthcoming. Life Against Dementia is due out this year, and Stone Mail will be published in 2012. All of these books are, or will be, available from Readout Press. Most importantly, for purposes of this interview and the book Enter Naomi, Joe was part owner and office manager of SST Records from 1981 through 1986. SST was a seminal independent record label based in Los Angeles from 1978 throughout the 1980s. They released records by Black Flag, Minutemen, Meat Puppets, St. Vitus, Saccharine Trust, Husker Du, Sonic Youth, and Bad Brains, just to name a few. Enter Naomi revolves around Naomi Peterson, the staff photographer for SST through most of the 80s. Naomi makes her appearance into SST Records in 1981, just after Joe enters the scene. She enters after having a particularly rough night that includes a liaison with SST staffer Mugger, some tough love from her father, and cutting her own wrists. Not knowing where to go, she calls SST in the middle of the night where Chuck, another SST staffer, answers the phone and invites her to stay the night at SST headquarters. Soon after, when it becomes known that Naomi takes pictures, she's invited to become the label's photographer. And she takes photos with gusto, shooting promo shots, stills, album covers, live footage of virtually every SST band and musician in the 1980s. Naomi Peterson died in 2003 due to complications associated with a lifetime of alcoholism. Joe Carducci found out about her death 2 years later while at a screening of We Jam Econo, a documentary of the Minutemen. Enter Naomi is Joe's recounting of the years between when Naomi entered SST Records and her death. Along the way, he tells us about his role at SST, Naomi's role there, the inner workings of the label, including discussions about many of the central as well as peripheral characters that made the label go, and LA punk rock world of the 1980s. Joe also provides insight into the passions that drove SST staffers to do what they did for little to no financial compensation, as well as a glimpse into the gender dynamics that existed within LA's punk scene. Joe lives in Centennial, Wyoming, which is where I reached him for this interview. Well, hello, Joe, and welcome to New Books in Popular Music.
Hi, man.
So tell us, Joe, could you please, you have an interesting story on your impetus for writing Enter Naomi in the first place. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, I didn't think of it. I wasn't thinking of writing, a memoir or anything about SST. As I was leaving the record business, I wrote my first book, Rock and the Pop Narcotic, just because things were still trapped underground, and not that some of the underground didn't like, to stay underground. But, I mean, I grew up hearing, great music on AM radio, and so my intention was always, how can you break through? And so we never succeeded at what I know Greg Ginn and Chuck Dukowski intended, which was, not to develop a little indie market, with a cool to go with it or a lifestyle or something. It was, a much more ambitious attempt, to put the new Jimi Hendrixes on the radio, like the old Jimi Hendrix was on the radio. And out of the blue, I heard not only that our photographer, Naomi Peterson, had died, but that it had been 2 years since she died. And I'm still in touch with, a fair number of the SST musicians and people I worked with. And so that was kind of shocking. The musicians back then made no money, but I guess in the back of my mind, the way the girls lived in Los Angeles in the music scene was, you know, probably not what you would advise, say, your sister, you know, to do. and so, you know, there was a sense that, wasn't a car accident death. This must have been, you know, something in and of the life of that era. And yet I didn't, you know, that there was no connection between her family and anyone. So I did a people search and found the likely address, and eventually her brother got in touch with me. And you know, and as I met him, talked to him, talked to other people, I knew I wanted to write and post an obituary of some sort online. And try to trigger some magazine, maybe like Spin or Rolling Stone, to do something. But there's just no way, you know, there's no way out of the ghetto they put us in a long time ago, you know, going back to the Ramones in the late 70s. It's just you're not for the grown-ups table. So I had to, you know, as I found the story, I then thought that it would be a book, and that I could say a lot about her and those girls in that scene. I mean, she was 17 or something when she first crossed paths with Black Flag, you know, had her camera, and it wasn't Black Flag I needed photos of. Everyone was taking photos of them, but nobody would take photos of the Minutemen or the Meat Puppets, and, you know, or Sacred Trust. I just needed someone who would do that for us, and that's the beginning, really.
Mm-hmm. So tell us briefly a little bit of your biography up until you reach SST Records.
Well, I grew up in Naperville, Illinois, outside of Chicago, and I wasn't interested in college. I mean, I went for a year and a half. I got interested in movies in high school, and so I moved to Hollywood in 1976, you know, having started writing screenplays. And I was in Hollywood for a year, you know, it's such an alien environment. I mean, to me, it didn't seem, I mean, that's probably the worst air pollution era of Los Angeles was the mid-70s. I mean, it was just dreary. Sun was almost a joke, you know. I didn't understand how tourists would be wandering around Hollywood Boulevard, you know, thinking like this was really something they were seeing.
Right.
So I moved to Portland then. And that's where I got into the record business, just because, you know, I spent a year submitting scripts, or, you know, it just seemed, the movie business seemed unfathomable to me. And I wasn't, you know, a good enough writer at that point. I was 21. And so I moved to Portland and got involved in independent record distribution. And we were connected to Rough Trade. And we were their outlet into the American market, and we were doing that for American independence as well.
This is Systematic Record Distribution. Is that who it is?
Yeah, we didn't. It was just, it developed out of a record store up there called Renaissance in 78, 79, and then we moved to Berkeley and changed the name to Systematic at the very beginning of 80.
Mm-hmm. And somehow you end up moving back to Los Angeles.
Yeah, I was in Berkeley for a couple of years, and the distributor, you know, put out Dead Kennedy singles and a few other things, but there were no pressing plants in San Francisco, and the bands didn't seem, I mean, I wasn't planning on staying in the record business because bands were not making it. And they weren't doing much about it either. I mean, the Dead Kennedys had done a little bit of touring and got a, you know, a record released out of London, but that just sort of screwed them up further because, you know, their record was $2 or $3 more than any American band's record in a record store, and there was no tour support, you know, for an import record. Not that there was ever any tour support, you know, but, you know, then I met Black Flag, and they were doing something completely different. And
you were in Berkeley when you met them?
Yeah. They had got up to Portland just as we were leaving, so I remember blown off the gig because we were getting up at 4 a.m.
So literally just as you were leaving.
Yeah, so I just missed them. I had written for their single, and that got rerouted by the post office down to Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the Nervous Breakdown 45.
Right.
And But I saw them a couple times because they were playing up and down the West Coast at that point. Into 81. And basically, they just had the Nervous Breakdown and the Jealous Again records out, and then the Minutemen 7-inch, the first one. And the Minutemen put out a couple of compilation albums, so I was, you know, aware that there was, you know, something down there. I was mostly interested in L.A. in terms of music because of the Danger House label and Slash magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I think those were, you know, those were... so much that Danger House was, they were the best label as far as they'd put out a run of 7-inch records.
And, so, what are some of the bands they released?
Well, they did X and they did, The Bags and Rhino 39, Black Randy. It was, you know, basically the scene down there in Hollywood. Although, you know, Rhino 39 were a beach band. I think they were Huntington Beach, and they were an early band, more from that area, OC and South Bay. And but you know, I met Black Flag. I saw how good they were, and I saw that they were touring, and they were just they were doing it.
And, right.
They had some people with them, like Spot and Mugger, who were willing. I mean, Greg was, you know, when you met Greg, you were inclined to, I mean, Black Randy was about this most cynical guy you could imagine. I mean, you know, his records are really foul-mouthed and diabolical. But, you know, he was one of the owners of Danger House. And even he was saying, you know, it's in the Brendan Mullen book, The Neutron Bomb. He said that everyone had a missionary drive, and that's a very good word for it, because, you know, we were so, you know, in a way we were 10 years after we'd all probably really been in love with music as kids, you know, listening to whatever, the Rolling Stones and Jimi Hendrix and, you know, what was going on.
You are all in your mid to late 20s by now.
I mean, Greg, Chuck, Spot, and myself were, Mike Watt, Pettibone, we were about the same age. So we were in our, I would say, mid, late 20s when I get back down to SST. And Mugger and Henry and Naomi, they're still teenagers or 20, you know.
Right.
So there was like two age groups, I would say, in and around SST.
So can you tell me then a little of Naomi's biography leading up to SST Records?
Well, and again, I didn't know any of this at the time. I mean, she came into SST, you know, in the middle of the night, having cut her wrists, and then called SST. I don't know why a girl would do that, but she knew Black Flag, and, you know, and Chuck answered the phone and told her to come in, and we all lived in a one room office basically, which had a bathroom, and so I met her the next day, you know, and you know, and Chuck was thinking, this girl needs some help, and Joe's been complaining about photographs, and she has a camera, and her, you know, it's a complicated story as far as, you know, how the parents met. I mean, her father was a Mormon artist who was serving in the military in Japan, and her mother was a unbeknownst to her, was not the daughter of a Buddhist priest, but a niece who'd been placed with them as a child by poor rural parents. And that somehow that that led her to say yes to a GI, even though they really didn't speak the other's language. And at the time, and they came and moved to Utah. They got married in Japan and moved to Utah, got married again, then they moved to L.A. so that they were around some people Naomi's mom could speak Japanese to. And so she grew up in Los Angeles, and she had an older brother, and he describes himself as kind of a good son who didn't, you know, push against the rules. And Naomi was the opposite. You know, she's a very, very positive personality. But, you know, I can see that she, you know, in Los Angeles, at first she was trying to work with Simi Valley kids from her high school and who were doing a band or doing a fanzine. And they weren't really doing anything. You know, they were just talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so once she was 16, she got a car and started, you know, in L.A., you could hear, unlike the rest of the country, you could hear the Ramones on the radio and the Damned and all this stuff. Black Flag, even, you know, Rodney Bingenheimer on K-Rock. And during the rest of the week, K-Rock was a good station. And this is the late 70s and 81. And so, you know, she heard these ads for Black Flag gigs. They always bought their own ads and did their own, you know, promotions. And none of the other punk bands did that in L.A. and or anywhere else. I mean, I used to tell Greg and Chuck that I thought they couldn't have happened in any other city. And, you know, they thought they were the same people and they would have been the same people, and they didn't agree. But, you know, I grew up in Chicago, and I knew how retarded it was musically in terms of, you know, there were some people trying to do punk rock, but, you know, when Black Flag came through all those towns around the country, I mean, people couldn't believe what they were doing, how they were living.
Right.
And, but anyway, and for Naomi, you know, she was, kind of, advanced in terms of art because of her father. And she's half Japanese and, half, I think the rest is Dutch and, Norwegian, I think. But, you know, Simi Valley, I looked at the yearbook that she's in. She quit high school probably in the third year. And it wasn't all white or anything. So I don't quite, you know, I wasn't, you mentioned John Savage's, you know, tapes of all his interviews. You know, for my world, if you put a tape recorder in front of people, they're just not going to talk. So
right.
I only spoke with people or emailed them, and you know, I'm not a professional writer in that sense. You know, I write screenplays or I write about art. You know, that's it. I'm not a reporter.
So How about telling us a little bit about the history of SST Records, even maybe a little bit before you got there, and then.
Mm-hmm. Well, Greg didn't intend to run a record label, but he had already, run an electronics company, which he called SST Electronics, and he was into ham radio. And he was, a genius, and he had invented things in his early teens. He ran a fanzine about ham radio when he was 12 or 13, and he started inventing electronic reception boosters and stuff like that. And he was putting these things together and selling them. And you can, see some of the equipment, and it's got the same old SST logo that was designed for the electronics stuff.
Yeah, I read an interview with him recently, or saw it on YouTube, where I guess people still come up to him with these old components and ask him to sign them.
It's hilarious because, you wouldn't think there's any crossover at all, but Black Flag became this sort of secret, after they stopped being a band. They just became kind of like the gold standard for the real shit. And,
mm-hmm.
And because it's word of mouth, it's bulletproof, I think. Kids hear it in their teens, and it's not like anything else they've heard,
Still.
But of course, some of the best writing I've read about the band's music, I'm trying to remember who did it, but they were guessing at the connection between ham radio static and Greg's distortion. Because, of course, he rebuilt his guitars. He took the worst guitar, I think it's the Dan Electro, I don't know guitars, so I could be wrong. There's a couple of Dan-type guitars. But, it was not considered a usable instrument
right.
because of the tone. But he replaced the pickups and did something and really, really liked it. Today he might be playing a different guitar, but through those years it was always that one Lucid body that he had.
So you're telling me about the history of SST Records.
So Greg, as I understand it, he paid no attention to music. His younger brother, Raymond, did. Probably Raymond was... also a genius. That's all you can say about him.
And that's Pettibone, right?
Yeah, and I knew their family. I mean, there were five kids, and the mother was from Estonia and met the father in London during World War II. And Mr. Ginn was Irish, Mrs. Ginn told me he had tested in the Air Force at an IQ of 175. And the kids are all different, but, just very high-quality people. And Raymond probably, as a young teenager, was really into radio and music and sports and comics and, everything. And then literature and, high art and he's just gone supernova basically. I mean, when I see him now, he's just completely, his interface with the universe is total, I guess is how you put it. But, he is a very quiet person. And in a sense, I guess that Greg at some point turned on the music. They were reading about the Ramones and CBGBs. Patti Smith was even a little ahead of that. So this is the mid-70s. They're reading the Village Voice, and then they're ready to go see the Ramones and Television and these bands when they start showing up in L.A. in 76 and 77. And Greg just turned on to it started writing songs without a band or anything. And that's in 76. And then the band comes together with Keith Morris and playing drums at first. And I think Raymond was playing bass in a kind of an arrangement. You know, they were learning, how do you do this? How do you put two instruments together? Raymond doesn't claim he was ever in the band, but he was, you know, definitely involved in the origins of it all. And Spot was a music writer for the Free Weekly in Hermosa Beach. And so Greg began to talk to Spot about music regularly, and that was how that connection got made. And then they needed a practice place, and they shared a derelict bathhouse with Bukowski, who had his own band called Worm, and W-U-R-M. And they go back into the early 70s. He's more of a, you know, he had been into hard rock. And that was the other thing about Los Angeles, is a lot of those kids, the Red Cross and the Descendants, they went to arena shows all through the 70s, Mike Watt and Dee Boone.
Right.
And this is a time when, you know, I say in the book, you'd go to the Long Beach Sports Arena. Well, you might see Gentle Giant and ZZ Top and Uriah Heep. Or you might see Moxie and King Crimson and, you know, just ridiculous. It was at a very high level of music. Some of it was blues rock. Some of it was prog rock. Some of it was, dumb hard rock, you know, and some of it, everybody was smoking pot, I guess, or, you know, it was the place you could smoke pot and get drunk. But that economy sort of, I don't know, that was ending, and it was becoming for kids, whereas it had been part of the late 60s hippie thing.
Right.
Now, I guess older music fans could smoke pot, you know, in their apartment or something, and they just stopped going to gigs, and so in a way it got to be for younger males mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And that was this before heavy metal, and then it kind of became heavy metal. And those guys were always connected to hard rock in a way that, you know, the typical punk rock was not later on, especially.
Mm-hmm. What was
because Greg and Chuck were older, and some of the younger kids were, connected to them and doing that.
And it seems in some of the other writing on the LA punk scene, like, you know, Brendan Mullins and Michael Azarods, they talk about this early Hollywood punk scene around The Mask, and you have The Germs and The Weirdos and X, and then they insert Black Flag and SST, and they seem to be suggest that there's something changes. It becomes more violent, is one of the main things they say, and it becomes younger.
What LA was, you know, it was a huge place, and the people in Hollywood did not take advantage of that. They, they were kind of a classic demimonde. They were dropping out, and they didn't, they didn't have the interest in suburban kids. So why would they go to Downey to play, or, you know, to Huntington Beach? The only band that really did was the Germs. They played the Fleetwood in Redondo Beach several times, and those were the first gigs where you had the South you know, the South Suburban Los Angeles area, seeing an LA punk band at a known rock venue, you know, and Patti Smith had played there. You know, she wrote a song called Redondo Beach and for the second album, I think. And, you know, it's from their tour and they played Fleetwood because you could, it's hard to play anywhere else. You know, they typically would play the Whiskey up in Hollywood. And, you know, most bands would just call that it for LA, but you know, you're asking people to drive an hour and a half to see you if that's the only place you play in LA. So if you're down in Hermosa Beach, like Black Flag, well, I mean, you know, that's what I mean. That they were, if I was going to stay in their music business for another few years, I wasn't going to work with the Dead Kennedys. Even though I liked those guys, they were good. They were not, they were just going to sit around mostly. And, you know, they wrote songs and they recorded them, but, it wouldn't be worth my time. And with Black Flag, you knew something was going to happen. So, you know, and I was enough of a political radical that I definitely wanted to see what was possible. And then I also, you know, was learning something about how art can have an impact, and thinking that would apply later to, you know, my own writing at some point.
At the same time, as you've already mentioned once, and I read it, and again, one of the Brendan Mullen books, you guys didn't necessarily, you had aspirations. I mean, Black Flag thought maybe they could get some of their songs on the radio.
Yeah.
You weren't necessarily.
At first, the Nervous Breakdown 7-inch, which has four songs on it, you know, they recorded that in Hermosa Beach with Spot, I think was the second engineer at that point. And they sent it up, and Bomp Records said they would release it. They had released The Weirdos and some other stuff. At that point, the last 45, they were also from Hermosa. And they sat on it for six, seven months, and then they really got into power pop. So they heard about the Shoes from Chicago and put them together with The Last and 2020 and a couple other bands. So they just lost interest in punk rock. And so Greg thought, well, we'll just use, he's still doing the electronics company. And so he just used all of that, the banking account, the name, the logo, and released Nervous Breakdown himself. And, you know, it sold 1,000 records very quickly, and they put a second run out. I was still up at Systematic. I couldn't get my hands on any of those copies. They all sold in LA. And so I didn't get the Nervous Breakdown single until it was in its 3,000. And at that point, that's when the record begins to, because Systematic was pretty much it as far as how was anyone out around the country, you know, going to buy a LA punk rock record. It went through Systematic, and so they were doing, there was a buzz about them because of how they played and people who saw them in LA. And then, you know, on one of their, might have been their second gig, they saw the Minutemen. Actually, they were the Reactionaries still, I think, and the Descendants were on that too. But Greg wanted to record the Minutemen and do a second 7-inch record. And so I don't know if they really, he thought of the label as kind of a last option. If no one else wanted to do your record and you were good, he would do it. I came down from Systematic and I probably introduced the impulse to do it as a full service label, which they were moderately resistant to, because they didn't want the Meat Puppets or the Husker Du or, you know, some of the bands to count on too much. And you know, and they didn't really. I mean, they were Black Flag by then had a, you know, a huge reputation in that Azrad book. I think Gibby from the Butthole Surfer says that the whole idea was to be as cool as Black Flag, because they just blew into town, you know, did these astonishing gigs, you know, and were gone. And then the second time they came through, there was, you know, it was the most amazing thing anyone had seen. Because, you know, even if you had gone to see the Ramones or you'd gone to see whoever was touring on a more showbiz level, you know, you were looking up from a distance to see the Ramones typically.
Right.
Black Flag were often on the floor playing, you know, directly at you, and they were walking around beforehand. I mean, they were playing places. There was no backstage. There's no nothing. So it was so accessible. It just inspired people on a whole other scale. You know, the Ramones basically inspired people by their record. When that first record came out, people who were kind of, you know, they might have been into Jonathan Richmond or the Stooges or, you know, something, and were looking for that kind of a knowing band, you know, that would reference so much of the good 60s garage rock. You know, that's sort of what the sensibility was. And Black Flag was a deeper, more direct phenomenon than that. Mm-hmm.
What about talk about Naomi just a little bit. What about her photography? Can you tell us some of the qualities of her photography that strike you? Some important features of it.
Well, I think what you can tell is that she was of the scene, and so there's no put on from the musicians. You know, Mike Watt always used to kind of laugh and say, you know, this is later in the period. They went on the tour with REM at some point, but in that period, you know, you'd always be seeing REM photos everywhere in the mid and late 80s. And he laughed that there was, you know, that someone always has a prop in a REM photo. And who knows why? I mean, but, you know, they're putting on something.
Right.
In our case, it was like showbiz with zero glamour. And so the girls who were around were, you know, were, I don't know. You know, I don't know. I mean, that's part of why I was interested in trying to figure it out, is why were they there? You know, I mean, there was animal sex appeal, but it wasn't dressed up. The musicians didn't dress up. I mean, up in the Dead Kennedy scene and what came out of the Dead Kennedy scene was a very political punk rock movement. And, you know, it included leather jackets, it included graffiti shirts and, you know, stuff like that. But in LA and in the South Beach in particular, it was beachwear, you know, and kids sort of lived outdoors in Los Angeles, and so they often had a real practical thing about, but it had glamour and sex appeal, but it was a thrown off casual thing, which in a subtle way made it more dramatic to you know, people around the country.
So you see this translating into Naomi's photos?
Yeah, and you look at the photos, he was not he was not concerned about her reputation as a photographer. So, you know, other photographers might get pissed off if bands were, you know, making them look dumb by asking them to do this or to do that. And, you know, so there's some dumb looking shots that she took because the bands wanted to be on a playground equipment or, you know, they wanted to do this or that. And she would always do that. She wasn't pretentious in that sense. But you know, people wrote about it, and I quoted some of the emails I got after I posted the obituary, because the photos they looked at in fanzines were printed mostly on terrible paper and fairly small. And so, you know, her photos didn't get printed, you know, commensurate, you know, in conditions commensurate with their musical importance, put it that way. And so, you know, it was just part of this dashed off culture that was very young. It had impatience and, I don't know what it communicated, impatience and a kind of, you know, we know what we're doing, and if you're not into it, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, not all the bands were like that exactly, but they got comfortable with her. And so, you know, there's just that thing in her photography. And this is primarily, I'm talking from 82 to the point at which she moves to D.C. in 88. I think technically her work is the best in stuff I've seen in 86 and 87, where it seems like maybe the bands are playing in clubs that have a little bit better lighting, and so her options are a little better, and you know, some real nice prints of the Meat Puppets and Red Cross in that period.
Mm-hmm. You've already spoke to this just a little bit, but maybe you can expand on it, because I think it's an important part of the book, where you emphasize you know, gender and gender relations, not just at SST, but maybe in the LA punk scene. Do you want to talk a little more about that, please? You said it's, you know, it's a boys, man's, you know, music scene.
Well, yeah, you know, a key figure when you're talking about the sex aspect of the scene was Mugger, and he was, you know, he was 17 when I got down there, and because I remember we were in West Hollywood first. And about 6 months later, we moved back down to Redondo Beach, and somewhere down in Redondo Beach in 82, I think he turned 18, and he was bemoaning the fact that he could now be arrested for statutory rape, and because he got laid a lot. And they were young girls, and what can you say about Los Angeles? I mean, something played out in Los Angeles that didn't really play out the same in the rest of the country, and it had to do with, again, people live outdoors, so they mix, young kids mix outside of school, and the pill was, whatever. You know, I don't know, there's a lot of divorce in Los Angeles, a lot of trends were, you know, incubated in Los Angeles as this giant experiment, so, you know, it was just that was Mugger had this ability to break down. He, you know, it's like he knew what the girl was interested in, despite the common defenses of, you know, pro forma shyness.
Mm-hmm.
And he was shameless at it, you know, and actually he schooled the older guys in how to get laid because, you know, just intellectuals have to learn their way to something that he, who lived on the street, I mean, he had run away from home maybe at 15 or something. And, but you know, that was a, that was what was great about LA. It was so unusual. Mugger had a band when he was, you know, just 14 or 15, and he's playing in a band with two black kids. And the black kids' parents were, you know, bourgeois folks, you know, doctor's son and somebody else. And he was telling me this, that, you know, that those black parents did not want Mugger to come over. Even though he's probably, you know, he's a white guy, but he's probably part Mexican or something. And, you know, so you just hear these strange reversals of anything you can imagine in Los Angeles, because this overwhelming, in a way, it's the old ideal, the post-war ideal of moving to California. And then LA is just, it is a major city. It's not like San Diego where, you know, maybe they kept that ideal going of a couple decades later. But, you know, they all moved to LA and got a divorce and their kids hate them and, you know, are living, growing up on the street and, you know, all this stuff starts happening. And a thing like punk rock on the East Coast and in Chicago sort of had this mandate to that had something to do with turf gangs of the East Coast tribal city, and then to break out of the neighborhood aspect of it, it just migrated into the punk style, became the turf, and that was, there was nothing like that in Los Angeles.
So you write that. I'm trying to stay on the gender thing just a little bit. Naomi traded on sex appeal. How was she treated at SST Records by the men?
Well, I mean, she was at first treated like all the girls who were around, you know, and again, this is Mugger's insight that what they wanted was sex. And it's a little different because when a band is touring, they're at a huge advantage because the local girls know they're going to leave town and they're not going to run into them at the laundromat or the, you know, the market or, you know, around town again and be mortified, you know, because they made a big mistake. But in LA, it was a little odder because Black Flag would play up in Simi Valley and they'd play in the valley and they'd play in the desert and they'd, you know, they toured L.A. almost continually, even when they weren't touring. And no other bands, I mean, some of the later punk bands adapted into that and you know, played around town like that. But they were, in a way, approachable stars. And they were nice guys. I mean, they were fairly... I don't know what, you know, every terms about sex are loaded, of course, but they were the kind of guys that Naomi thought would help her when her father wouldn't let her back in the house that night.
Mm-hmm.
He was, you know, it was 3 or 4 in the morning and she went to them you know, it was, I don't know. I mean, she had girlfriends occasionally, but she was, an outsider in I think, female, society, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I read a little bit about that to write the book. And the one book I read was the subtitle of it is, I think, The Myth of the Slut or something like that.
Right.
I forget the title of it. It's in, you can find it in the book. But the woman isolated five elements. One, and this led to being considered a slut by other girls in a high school.
All right.
And they were maturing physically early, ahead of, you know, your cohort, being ethnically exotic in some way. What are the other three? Transferring into the school from outside. Anyway, Naomi hit the jackpot, you know, full house.
Right.
And so I eventually got in touch with a classmate of hers who read the book, but, you know, the book was already done then. But her brother told me that she was pushed around even by guys, you know, and the way I took it, this is her, she transfers in to the second year of high school, and she doesn't finish the third year.
Mm.
And I think the girls froze her out. Because, like I said, I mean, there wasn't a brighter smile on a hot chick you ever saw. You know what I mean? And good-looking girls usually tone it down. You know, they don't walk around with their brights on. Because, you know, but she was just interested in men and interested in learning things and... And she went to the art class, of course, and her father was, you know, interested in her being an artist, but he thought, you know, he just didn't trust rock and roll, that would lead anywhere, and, you know, and you know, and nobody thought it was going to lead anywhere. We were convinced that, you know, they were... You know, the worst of the hippies had taken over radio and Rolling Stone and the record labels, and they were just going to force you to listen to garbage, you know, for then on.
Right. So, Joe, why did you leave SST?
Well, I once we weren't all living in one office together, I started to write again. You know, I was a little bit older, and I had seen, seen a lot of movies in those years, and doing some reading about whatever politics and literature, and so I had some ideas, and so I wrote two or three more scripts, and I thought I need to try to, you know, make a step from the music business into what I really want to do, which is to write screenplays. And I couldn't, you know, there really was no connection. You know, now I think there's, you know, Black Flag fans and you know, and in the film business, but there wasn't any crossover at that point at all. And there wasn't an independent film scene even, you know, really. So, I was just getting into that again, and then Black Flag, it was, you know, we were on the outs, basically, because, again, my sense of a record label, you know, if that's all I was doing there, was to make it a real record label, and I think Greg and Chuck, they wanted to improvise the company in a way that made it hard for you to, say, deliver on some band's fourth album, you know, coherently promotion-wise and stuff. And so I knew that Black Flag was ending in 86. And so the company was on its feet enough that I could leave with some money. Mm-hmm. If I had left 2 years earlier, I wouldn't have been able to take any money with me because, you know, we had the big court problem with Black Flag and a distributor label.
Right.
That we made a deal with. So
that we were, you know. Why does Naomi leave SST?
Well, it's interesting because I had to think through all this and try to remember things. I worked with Naomi as she was a freelance photographer. and she was on call, and we paid for all of her film and paper and developing chemicals and anything she needed, then we gave her that. We didn't really pay her until probably 85, say, for a, you know, per photo on an album cover or that kind of thing. We didn't use a lot of photos on album covers in the early period. I mean, people were putting art on the albums, but eventually there was photography done for album covers, and so she got some money for that. And then as I'm leaving, she begins to work at the label. We had two offices by 85, and one was where Black Flag practiced and did their booking, and they did more and more promotion. Again, as you know, there's this sort of split between Greg and Chuck and Black Flag and me and Mugger at SST, where we're dealing with, you know, a dozen bands and trying to schedule out record releases for the next year and do well by them. You know, they weren't interested in that, really. And but anyway, so Naomi's working over there as, you know, part of their office. Mm-hmm. And that means booking tours, you know, working the phones plus the photography and probably management, you know, chores and stuff like that. And they were managing bands other than Black Flag out of that office too, as I recall, and booking a bunch of bands. And so she was part of that scene come probably the end of 85, and I leave in March 86. So she's working there, and we were moving the company every year because we didn't have enough room for the records we were pressing and releasing. And so after I left, they moved a couple times and wound up down in Long Beach. And she worked there and just didn't like it. I mean, she was burned out on Greg and Chuck, and the wheels were maybe beginning to fall off the company at the end of the 80s. And she was tired of LA. I mean, she had traveled to Germany and, you know, and, I reprinted a bunch of her letters to me, and she was, burning to leave town and go to DC and travel also, just, you know, go to, in particular, Germany and Europe generally. She's very interested in seeing that and went back a few times.
And so what are you up to now, Joe? What are you working on?
Well, I had my first book, Rock and the Pop Narcotic, through Henry Rollins Book Company. And then he pulled back to just his own titles. And so I had my book back, and I had to figure out, do I want to be in the publishing business, you know? And the answer was no, but, you know, I thought you can't get, it's not worth it to give it away to somebody. And nobody big was, you know, thought it was worth anything. So I'm in the book business, and I've got two more books coming. After I did the rock book, I began work on a film book because that's my continuing interest. And I'm just hoping to get that out next year. And it's in a way, it's an analog to the rock book.
And that one's called Stone Mail, right?
Yeah. Stone Mail, Requiem for a Film Style. And it's basically about how film always had a big part of what they now call actuality. The earliest films were actualities, just a little like a 50-second document of a train pulling into a station. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people had never seen that projected on a wall. They'd seen a train, but, you know, they hadn't seen a film of a train. And in terms of acting, film acting involves a lot of actualities. You know, a guy is a horse wrangler, and he can, you know, make the horse fall and do a tumble without killing himself. Well, put him in a movie and give him some lines. Well, he becomes an actor. And there's a lot of film acting that is that kind of acting. There's no stage training whatsoever. And I just thought, well, you know, they keep talking about what is a good actor, and it's Sean Penn or it's Marlon Brando or, you know, someone trained. And to me, Ben Johnson is a great actor, and Richard Farnsworth, and, you know, those, you know, neither is alive now. But when you're watching those guys, you're seeing something better than acting. And I just thought there's a whole, you know, book to trace that through the history of film. And so that's what I'm doing. And for that book, and then I'm writing screenplays, and I've got a book out of Wyoming stories, it's called, and it's got three of my screenplays that are set in Wyoming where I live. And the first one is in development, or, you know, in whatever you call it, with a producer. So that looks like it'll get made next year. That's called Young Girl. And, you know, that's been, I mean, I'm 55 and I've been waiting for that for, you know, a long fucking time.
And why'd you end up in Wyoming?
Well, I used to drive between Chicago and L.A. a lot, and this was the most interesting place. I mean, I like St. George, too, but this is the most interesting place as you're driving through that you begin to notice. And in this corner of the state, you're kind of in the far orbit of the Denver metropolitan area, so you're connected to a reasonable-sized city, although Colorado is much dumber than Wyoming. It's, you know, it's there. So I go down to Boulder to see silent films once in a while at the Chautauqua down there. So, you know, there's some culture down there that you can get. And music plays there, although I don't go down there too often. The Descendants are based in Fort Collins, and they have a studio there. So I still have an aura in there somewhat.
Did you go see Meat Puppets when they were in Wyoming a month or last year?
No, I don't think they played in,
they played at Grand Targhee Ski Resort.
That's right. Yeah, that's the other side of the state.
Yeah.
I was talking to their manager and you know, telling them, well, I'll go down to Fort Collins to see them, but I won't go down to Boulder and Denver. It's just too far. But yeah, I'd like to see them. I hear good things about them, and skinned your interview with them, and you know, those guys, they're very smart guys. I'm glad Chris survived.
Well, thanks a lot, Joe, for the interview. I appreciate you being on our show.
Well, yeah, thanks. I'm glad you're interested, and glad to hear from you. And I'll be checking the site for sure.
You've been listening to an interview with Joe Carducci, author of Enter Naomi, SST, LA, and All That, published in 2007 on Redoubt Press. Please check the New Books and Popular Music site regularly for more interviews with authors of books about popular music. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. Thanks for listening.